Hi there, listeners of Accents, a podcast for literature, arts and culture. I'm your host, Katerina Stoikova, and I have the pleasure of serving as the director of the Kentucky Book Festival, a program of Kentucky Humanities. The next installment of KBF will take place on November 2nd at Joseph Beth Booksellers from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Today's episode features an author who will participate in the festival. This is fiction writer Josh Bolt. Josh, welcome to Accents.
Hi, thank you.
Congratulations on publishing your latest novel, Moneymaker. Please tell the listeners of Accents, who is Mac Abbott and what does he want in life?
What does he want in life? Okay, so a little bit of background, I guess. I write Southern crime fiction. This is my third novel, and I've kind of been building a world, sort of, in my first couple novels. All three have some connected characters, loosely. So Mac Abbott is a character who was just briefly mentioned in my past novel called Slurry. And he was a character that actually a lot of readers picked up on and were interested in learning more about. And so was I, for that matter. So I developed his character into the novel Moneymaker, where he is one of the primary characters. He is a former Navy man who is turned into a surveillance expert, doing some freelance work down in Atlanta, when he gets a call from a client and is asked to go to Savannah, Georgia, and track a narcotic shipment coming in off the coast on the beach.
Plot thickens.
The plot thickens, that's right.
Yeah.
So he goes over to Savannah and starts working on this case, and that's when things get a little weird.
And there is not only crime there is a little bit of romance.
Sure, there is. I like there to be a little bit of a romantic element in my novels, and Moneymaker's no different. So Abbott meets, through strange circumstances, you might say, he meets an exotic dancer at a club in Savannah, and they sort of strike up a little bit of a romance that burns throughout the novel.
It's a very interesting word that you chose, burns, because it's complicated.
It is. This particular character, her name is Avery Calloway. She is wrapped up in the story in ways that Abbott is not aware at the beginning. She has a bit of a taste for the smuggler's product, so there's kind of a triangle that enters into play between the smugglers, Mac Abbott, and this Avery Calloway character.
Would you like to read us a little bit from the book?
Sure. So I have to say, this is what I always tell my people who are asking about my three books. This is my rated R novel. So it was a little bit difficult to find some passages that were appropriate for radio. To be totally honest with you, I would have loved to have read something from the Avery Calloway character. She is probably my favorite character in the book, but she does not have a mouth that's appropriate for NPR podcasts. So we're just gonna have to. Avery Calloway will be waiting for those of you who are so interested. The story is, let me give you a little background. So the novel is basically told from the point of view of three characters. So we've got Mac Abbott, who you've already learned about. We've got Avery Calloway. We also get her perspective quite a lot throughout the novel. And then we also have a third perspective, which is from the smugglers themselves. So I've got a couple of key characters, one of whom is named Jerry Mewson. He is one of the smugglers, and he's a bad guy, but he's a very complex bad guy. I mean, we see a side of him in his house, interacting with his kids, with his wife. I feel like you know, he's a sympathetic character as far as I'm concerned. He's a character that I'm interested in and that I kind of root for, even though he is, you know, on the bad side of the law. So I am going to read first a section from this guy Jerry's perspective, Jerry Musin's perspective, and I'll give you a little bit of setup. So he has just done a long shift at the warehouse, protecting their drug shipment. Gets dropped off in the morning, drunk, at his house, and proceeds to pass out for 24 hours or so, and his wife is very disappointed with him. He wakes up in the morning and is trying to kind of make nice and make up for his behavior for the last day or so. And here he is in the morning, joining his family at breakfast. Jerry finished his pancakes. He set his plate in the sink and poured out a splash of water from the bucket to loosen the sticky syrup. He watched his daughter twirl her spoon in the leftover cereal milk. She sang a song to herself softly. Jerry could not make out the words. He figured they were made up, something the girl had taken to doing lately. "What are you learning at school today?" Jerry asked his daughter. She stopped singing. "I don't know." "Making a turkey with your hand?" "Huh? Didn't you ever do that? Put your hand on a paper and trace your fingers to make a turkey?" The girl scrunched her face in confusion. "You know what holiday is coming up, don't you?" The girl thought for a few seconds before answering. "Thanksgivings?" "That's right. When I was a little boy in school, we made hand turkeys for Thanksgiving." The girl looked at her hands, turning them from front to back, trying to understand her dad's words. "I'll show you this week. Remind me. We'll make hand turkeys." "Okay, Daddy." Jerry tried to kiss his wife's cheek, but she swerved away from him. He frowned and moved on, swinging open the screen door. He went outside to smoke a cigarette. Carefully stepping over glass from a broken beer bottle, he shook a cool mild from his soft pack and held it between his teeth while he fished in his pocket for a lighter. His hands came up empty. "Damn it." Jerry spat on a lone patch of driveway that had not been overtaken by tall weeds. Going back inside for a lighter would open the door to more berating from Billy if her mood turned. It was hard to know what might set her off these days. Jerry shuffled across the broken driveway that separated his house from the neighbors. He took each step gingerly to avoid cutting his feet on hidden objects in the tall grass. The neighbor's fat coonhound began thumping its thick tail when it saw Jerry approaching. The dog lay on her side in the morning sun. She lifted her head a couple inches and yawned, then laid back down, still thumping her tail slowly on the packed dirt next to a rotting deck under which she retreated when the afternoon sun reached peak heat. "Hey, girl, don't get up for me. I don't have anything for you," Jerry said to the dog, his teeth still clamped on the cigarette. Jerry took a few more steps into his neighbor's yard. "Roy, you in there?" He hollered in the direction of a cinder block garage behind the house. "Yep," answered Roy from within the garage. "That dog ain't worth the shit, is she?" Jerry said when he reached the open garage door. "Nope." "You got a light on you?" "Over here on the workbench somewhere, if you can find it." Roy was hunched over his workbench wearing a welder's mask. His torch sent sparks cascading on the dirt floor. "What are you up to in here?" Jerry asked when Roy straightened up and lifted the mask. The dark visor hinged and locked above Roy's head. "Building a yacht." Jerry cracked a smile. He located the cigarette lighter on the workbench and lit his smoke. "Do me a favor and put my wife on there when you get done. Send her on down to Cuba or anywhere else, long as I can't hear her talking." "Already this morning, huh? Brother, it never ends. You get your water back on yet?" Jerry pressed his toes into the cool dirt floor. "Nah." "Listen, Roy, I meant to thank you for letting us use your hose for a little while. I'm working on something that'll get us back in business in a day or two. It won't be long. Roy raised his eyebrows. Do I want to know? It's a sure bet this time. Once it comes through, first thing I'm going to do is stock your fridge full of Keystone for you. Hey, I'll get the good stuff. Coors Banquet. Imagine a fridge full of those golden beauties. That'll be the day, Roy coughed. Go on ahead if you want to, he said, knowing what Jerry was driving at. You sure? Might as well make room for one more banquet to fit in there. Jerry opened the garage fridge and took out a cold can of Keystone Light. The amber liquid cooled his throat. He drank the beer quickly and got another one. Roy, you're a damn good neighbor, you know it? I know it.
Lovely, thank you so much. Tell us about the research that went into writing this book.
Yeah, there was some research that went into it. I like to do that with all my books. My first novel, The False Favorite, takes place at several racetracks, Keeneland, Churchill Downs. It's set around the Kentucky Derby. So I have, over the course of my life, done a lot of research at the tracks. For that particular novel, I was able to call on that past experience. I'm a believer that you have to get out in the world and do things and listen to people, listen to what people say and the way they talk. You know, I really like to craft dialogue that, you know, that's the way people actually talk.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, and I wrote down brilliant dialogue.
Thank you. I say that my novels are Southern crime, and I try to have the South be like a character in the novel, so to speak. So, but for Moneymaker, there are scenes that take place at strip clubs. I'm gonna plead the fifth on some of this stuff, but let's just say I did some research in my 20s for this particular novel. So. I try to put myself in the place of some of the characters, so I understand what they're coming from. So, on a more serious note, I actually did do some real research for the character of Avery Calloway. For several years I wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Education and wrote a lot about higher education labor, particularly like adjunct professors. And when I was in that world, I met and connected with a woman who was an adjunct professor and also worked as a stripper. So we ended up writing and publishing a story called Stripper with a PhD. I don't know if it's still out there in the world or not, but during the course of writing that article, I had several extensive, you know, hours and hours of interviews with this particular adjunct professor. And she told me a lot about her experience. I mean, I really learned a lot about the world that, and the way that she blended her two separate lives. So, and a lot of that research really did actually inform Avery Calloway's character.
Should we look forward to seeing Avery in another book? Is she going to get a book of her own?
I think we can probably think about that possibility. Yeah, I mean, we've got two novels with Mac Abbott. In Slurry, he's an older man, middle-aged, I guess I would say. Here in Moneymaker, this is set 20 years prior to Slurry, so he's a young man here. I've thought about the possibility of maybe there being a third novel here where Abbott and Calloway are both older and they somehow reconnect later in life. I think that could be fun.
Well, Alexandre Dumas did it with great success.
Indeed.
What's your process? Do you put the crime in the novel or do you put the novel in the crime?
You know, I am not one of those people who has like a detailed outline of the way a novel is going to go. I typically just start with like a really loose idea and maybe like one or two characters that I'm interested in. And then the novel just really develops, and new, you know, I'm always surprised when new characters show up. I've got another passage that maybe we can read that has a character that just appears for one scene who I absolutely loved. I think she's a hilarious character. You know, it just kind of came out of the blue. I mean, I didn't even know that she was going to be in the novel. As far as the crime goes, I like reading crime novels. I mean, I always, you know, I kind of always have. I'm a huge Elmore Leonard fan. I've read most of his books, which is saying something because I think he wrote like 45 or 50. So I always want there to be some, you know, seedy or gritty element to my novels because that's just what I happen to be interested in. I always, with all three of my novels so far, I've known there was going to be some kind of a crime that takes place. There's going to be some, you know, so to speak, like bad guys, I guess, because I like writing those characters. You know, I kind of get into the, particularly in this novel, the anti-hero concept, you know, where you've got bad people, but they have likable characteristics. So I like showing multiple sides to a character.
And how do you keep track of details across multiple books?
Well, I had to go back and reread it. When I wrote Slurry, I had no idea that Mac Abbott was going to be a character of his own in a future novel. That was not planned. It was not intentional. So he just had a minor role in Slurry. So I had to go back and reread his sections to make sure I remembered. I wanted to remember his voice, you know, the way he talks, the way he acts. I wanted that to be fairly consistent. And then in this case, because he was 20 years younger in this new novel, I wanted to kind of show him as maybe a little bit more innocent, you know. He's a bit jaded by the time we get to Slurry, and I wanted to show him as a younger man who had just gotten discharged from the Navy, maybe a little bit more hopeful about the future. So it was important to me to maintain his character, but write him in such a way that we could sort of see his progression.
I'd love to hear another excerpt.
Okay, let's do it. So we got the Jerry Musin perspective. I'm going to give you a little bit of Mac Abbott with this one. He has arrived in Savannah. He's got a buddy with him who is helping him on his surveillance. His friend just went back to Atlanta, where he lives, and Mac is now alone in town. And he is trying to decide the best way to conduct his surveillance that will keep him, you know, discreet. So he decides he's going to pay a visit to an army surplus store. And this is where this scene begins. He's walking in to the surplus store to kind of gather some supplies. "Where'd you serve?" The question came from somewhere deep within the military surplus store, seconds after Mac stepped inside the building. The lighting in the store was dimmer than Mac had anticipated. He blinked a few times, allowing his eyes to adjust. The large warehouse smelled like machine oil, like an industrial lubricant, slightly sweet and pungent. Mac took a few steps into the warehouse. He peered around a rack of antique gas masks, searching for the man who had greeted him. A head of gray hair popped up suddenly to Mac's left from behind a white counter. The gray hair was cut so closely to the scalp that the clerk appeared nearly bald. A pair of thick black glasses covered half of the person's face. The lenses looked like telescopes, magnifying the eyes to nearly double their actual size behind the glass. The clerk dressed head to toe in camouflage, complete with insignias and patches. He even had a beige canteen strapped to his waist with a Velcro loop. Mac suppressed a smile at the clerk's cliched appearance. Something about the guy seemed slightly off, not what Mac would expect. He quickly scanned the clerk, trying to identify the idiosyncrasy. Then it struck him. The clerk's chin had a light dusting of whiskers, but the throat contained no Adam's apple. Mac's gaze traveled down the clerk's camouflaged body. "Yep, they're taped," bellowed the clerk. She slapped her chest with both palms. The dull thud knocked Mac out of his focused examination. I didn't, he stammered. I wasn't sure if, Smatter, ain't you ever seen a female soldier before? Soldier? Well, sure, I have, said Mac, still trying to find his footing in the conversation. All right then, quit your yammering and let me know how I can help you. Mac finally gathered his wits. Your voice is what threw me. It's so deep. Just blessed, I guess, shouted the woman. She sounded like she had lost most of her hearing, her voice excessively loud given the proximity of her listener. Mac took a step back. This time he did crack a smile. Navy, he said, answering her initial question. Say again, shouted the woman. Navy, Mac repeated, louder this time. See any action? Mac nodded, a little. Army myself, said the woman. 12B, combat engineer. That so? You'll have to excuse me. Damn near lost my hearing blasting a bridge. Thanks for your service, said Mac. Glad to do it, and I'd do it 100 more times if they let me, said the woman. She slapped her hands together. Now, what can the Army do for the Navy today? Mac explained he was looking for a discreet tracking device that would alert him when it moved. What are you, a PI? Asked the woman. Something like that. Reason I ask is I'm not supposed to sell that kind of thing to civilians. They say some might use it for following people. I say, well, what in the hell else would you use it for? Of course you use it for following. That's the whole point of a tracking device, you ask me. But don't nobody ever ask old Conrad, said the clerk. Nope, they just tell. They never ask. I don't give a good goddamn personally what you want to do with your own life. You know why I don't? Conrad didn't wait for Mac to answer. I'll tell you why, because it ain't none of their business. You want a tracker? I can get you a tracker. Sit tight for a minute, Navy. I got something in back going to blow your tits backwards when you see it. Mac couldn't help smiling at the clerk's boisterous rant. I'd appreciate that, Conrad, he said. Call me Connie, shouted the clerk as she disappeared around a display of empty artillery boxes. Mac browsed through the dusty shelves while he waited. He could hear Connie in the storeroom moving boxes and cursing to herself. Mac grabbed a bundle of paracord and some zip ties and tossed them on the counter. He was fingering a set of hemostats when he heard Connie's voice over his shoulder. Roach clips! She shouted with a proud smile, aware of the common civilian use for hemostats. Mac smiled and put the clips back on the shelf. This here's what you're looking for, young man, said Connie. She slapped a small metal box on the counter. Removing the lid, she withdrew a device about the size of a textbook. Connie turned a knob on the side of the box and the green LED screen came to life. Now take this and walk over to the other end of the warehouse, Connie instructed Mac. She handed him the tracker. Mac did as he was told. When he reached the back wall, he raised a hand to signal to Connie. Connie fidgeted with the tracking beacon and then gave a thumbs up to Mac. The screen in Mac's hand displayed, in blinking text, the words 150 feet. Mac took a few steps toward the counter and saw the number steadily decrease. He walked rapidly back to Connie until the screen displayed 2 feet. Not bad, said Mac. I like it. Connie beamed. Range goes up to 10 miles, Mac whistled. Ain't cheap, though. Not my dime, said Mac with a wink. That's the best kind of dime, said Connie. She rung up the tracker along with the paracord and zip ties, giving little more than an eyebrow raise at the combination of purchases. Best grab them clips, too, eh? On the house, Connie said, smiling. Never know when you might need them. Sure, said Mac. Why not?
Well, you know, this is both brilliant and hysterical. How do you do humor? I mean, that is really hard.
Thank you. I have a lot of practice. I have a text chain with a couple of friends, which basically exists solely to make each other laugh. That is like our whole goal in life, to make each other laugh. We really appreciate humor. So I have to shout out a couple of my buddies for that. But I don't know. I just really appreciate humor. I've always been somebody who likes to make people laugh, and I like to look for humor in things. So I think maybe this probably isn't an ideal answer, but it's one of those things that's just kind of ingrained in me. I look for humor. But as far as the dialogue goes and writing dialogue in, I mean, people talk like that, you know? Like that, like this character, Conrad, this is based on a person that I know, you know? I mean, not totally, but, you know, there are characters that are similar. I just really believe that if you pay attention to the way people talk, you can just learn a lot about the way to construct your own dialogue. This was the character that I was talking about earlier who... I didn't even know she was going to be in the novel. She just kind of suddenly appeared, and I thought she was hilarious, too. I mean, to be honest with you, when I read back over that, I'm having trouble not laughing. So I liked him. I take that as a good sign, I guess.
I love the cover and the design of the book.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. So that means a lot to me in particular because I designed the cover, as I did with all of my novels. So I have a background, graphic design, web design. That's kind of what I've done, and that's what I do still to this day for my 9-to-5. I have started writing novels because I wanted a creative outlet. You know, I studied English and bachelor's and master's degrees in English, and but I went on into tech because I needed a career that was going to sustain me. But I never, you know, I never lost sight of what I really enjoyed, and I always wanted to write for years. So when I started my first novel, The False Favorite, I did not think that it was something that I would ever publish. I thought just probably everyone says that, I guess. But I thought it was just something that I was going to do for fun, and little by little, it turned into a novel. So. I thought, well, maybe I should just put this out in the world, see if people bite on it, see if people think it's interesting, and I did, you know. So I indie published the first novel, like I said, designed the cover for it and put it out there, and I think because of the fact that it's set in Lexington and Louisville around a major event like the Derby, which a lot of people know. I got a little bit of traction. I mean, I had a lot of people who read it, who bought the book, and started getting like emails from random people saying, you know, like the book, when's the next one coming out? You know, so that built my confidence and made me feel like, okay, maybe I've got something going here. So, with the second novel, Slurry, I had a much more like, I had a plan, you know, to indie publish. And then with this novel, Moneymaker, this is the first novel that I've actually really tried to make like a public push and get it out there in the world and talk about it. Because I have some sales that have helped me feel confident about my work and know that maybe maybe I've got something here, you know? So thanks for saying that. And the cover itself. Yeah. I like it. I wanted it to be. I like my covers to be fairly simple. I don't want a lot going on the cover. I want them to be kind of stark, and catch your eye. This particular cover, as I guess anyone can see online, it's open to the interpretation. What might be on the cover? I guess let's just put it that way.
I think people can look it up.
That's right. There you go.
Who is Ruby?
Ruby? Ruby's my dog. She is a 70-pound coonhound who is my roommate and my buddy. She's about 9 years old now, and she's the creature that I talk to more than anyone else in this world.
You're an adventurer. You've held 50-some odd jobs. Can you speak a bit about that? Because it reminds me of Jack London and his adventures.
Oh my God, I take that as such a huge compliment. He's yeah. A kind of a hero of mine as far as the way he lived his life, because you know the way that he was just so into the idea of of experiencing life, you know, and then the writing comes from your experiences, and that's kind of my philosophy too. Yeah, I have had a lot of jobs, you know, and I guess maybe I'm tanking any future employment opportunities I have here. You know, a future employer finds out I've had that many jobs that maybe it doesn't look good on my resume, but this is my writing story. So it's mainly just I just like learning new things. I mean, I don't like to stay in one place for a long time because things just get stale and they get repetitive. And it's nothing against anybody or any place. I just like to learn new things and have new experiences. So I have not been shy about when something starts to feel stale to move on to the next adventure.
Well, to me, it does require a sense of adventure, but also confidence and trust in one's own abilities to navigate life and survive.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it certainly helps. I think I have to say that I do not have a family because that gives me a lot more freedom than maybe others might have to jump from one thing to the next. So that's a conscious decision that I've made in my life. There are times that I wish it was otherwise, and there are times that I'm really happy with the life that I've made for myself, you know, just like anybody, I guess.
Whatever decision you make, you'll be unhappy with it at some point, right? Might as well make the one that is in integrity with you.
I think that's good advice.
It wasn't advice, you know, was, you know, maybe note to self or something. I don't know. What are you writing now?
I have a fourth novel underway. It's fully drafted. Similar kind of Southern crime, although this is not in the world of the first three. I don't, as of right now at least, I don't have any overlapping characters. As you know, I do some part-time work at WUKY. So there is a radio station actually that figures heavily in this particular novel that I'm working on now. And a radio DJ who is a really fun character. I'm excited to write her character. Hopefully next year sometime, we'll see.
Sometimes I'm able to see into the future, and maybe, let's say, 9 months from now, you sit across me again and we speak about that novel.
I would love that.
And speaking about radio and podcasts, I think you are the only other person besides me who has listened to every single episode of Accents.
Well, we don't know for sure, I guess, but it's probably a fair assumption. I know we both have, because as I alluded to, I do work on the other side of the podcast world for WUKY, so I have published every one of your episodes on the WKY website. So, and it's been a real pleasure. I don't listen to every podcast I publish, but I listen to all of yours.
Let me take a moment to thank you and the fabulous team of WKY for your continued support of Accents. I appreciate you more than you know.
Well, we're glad to have you.
Thank you for coming to Accents, and I'll see you at the festival.
Thank you, Katerina.